IOM has raised an alarm over the high number of migrants killed while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. It has described the U.S.-Mexico border as the world's deadliest land route for migrants. At least 686 deaths and disappearances were reported in the border crossing last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded through the Americas in 2022, the deadliest year on record since IOM's Missing Migrants Project began in 2014. The data underscores the growing death toll and increasing risks that migrants face throughout the region. These figures represent the lowest estimates available, as many more deaths are likely to go unrecorded due to a lack of data from official sources. Nearly half of the deaths on the U.S.-Mexico border were linked to the hazardous crossing of the Sonoran and the Chihuahuan deserts, far more than other desert regions where irregular migration is prevalent.
The International Organization for Migration documented the deaths and disappearances of 686 migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2022, making it the deadliest land route for migrants worldwide last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded throughout the Americas last year, the deadliest on record since the Missing Migrants Project began in 2014.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers have taken long and perilous paths through South and Central America and Mexico in hopes of reaching the U.S. border to apply for protection. Many are fleeing rampant gang violence, poverty, political persecution, and other crises in their home countries. This is while the U.S. is accused of ignoring the plight of migrants. From an economic perspective, it is the U.S. that benefits from the contribution of migrants to the nation's GDP. Many of those immigrants that come to the U.S. through its southern borders end up working in farms and construction sites owned by big companies. It's been argued that increased immigration promotes U.S. economic growth and helps tackle labor shortages and inflation. U.S. President Joe Biden, who is under pressure from Republicans, has launched new restrictions and programs to discourage people from trying to apply for asylum at the frontier. The measures have been put in place amid record numbers of arrivals at the border since he took office in early 2021. The measures introduced by the Biden administration include a rule that disqualifies people from seeking asylum in the U.S. if they did not first apply in countries that they crossed earlier in their journeys. Rights groups have slammed the measure as an asylum ban. The Biden administration has also opened so-called safe mobility centers in Latin America to allow asylum seekers to apply for U.S. protection in third countries instead of at the border with Mexico. But migrants and asylum seekers continue to head to the border. For years, Central American nations have stepped up immigration enforcement efforts, often at the behest of the United States, erecting new obstacles for the steady stream of people making the journey north. The journey is plagued with violence, with areas under the control of criminal networks and armed groups.
The Darien Gap, an inhospitable jungle border crossing between Panama and Colombia, saw 141 documented migrant deaths in 2022. The remote and dangerous nature of this area and the presence of criminal gangs along the route means that this figure likely does not represent the actual number of lives lost.
The surge in arrivals has piled political pressure on the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, whose Republican rivals have accused him of causing chaos at the border. In 2021, U.S. authorities reportedly detained 1.7 million migrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border.
Let me be clear. The lifting of the Title 42 public health order does not mean our border is open. In fact, it is the contrary. Our use of our immigration enforcement authorities under Title 8 of the United States Code means tougher consequences for people who cross the border illegally.
Marking an all-time high and highlighting the deepening political and humanitarian challenges the Biden administration is facing on immigration. The U.S. has been increasingly reliant on Mexico to stem the flow of migrants. As it returns to Mexico, the majority of people who arrive at the border under a Trump-era border restriction enacted due to the coronavirus pandemic.
No more tears! No more tears!
I lost $10 an hour, 5 years seniority.
One of the striking auto workers in the U.S. Thousands of United Auto Workers are officially on a strike after three Detroit automakers failed to reach an agreement with the union.
What appears that now is going to happen is the UAW is planning targeted strikes across all three companies. So striking at just specific plants.
We're going to get to that story soon. But did you know that the U.S. is experiencing strikes in other sectors as well? From UPS, the carrier service, to Starbucks, the coffee chain.
We pull the shots!
We call the shots!
Workers at many U.S. companies are taking to the streets. In short, they are fighting for better pay and improved working conditions.
We have hotel workers on strike across the region, everywhere from the L.A. Grand, which joined the strike this morning, J.W. Marriott, Ritz-Carlton.
We have a very weak labor law. There are a lot of aspects of our economy and our politics that concentrate a lot of power in the hands of corporations.
And there may be more strikes to come. UPS employees started striking before reaching a deal. That would have involved some 340,000 workers. Close to 3,000 Starbucks workers protested what they called unfair labor practices. 1,400 members of the United Electrical Workers went on a strike after rejecting the company's contract offer. 6,000 workers at Boeing's Aerosystems went on a strike, also rejecting the company's contract offer. Add to that 80 Amazon drivers who protested unfair labor practices. And McDonald's employees in California went on a strike over paid sick leave. Well, it becomes evident how much of a common occurrence these strikes are. And we can't forget Hollywood. General Motors, Ford Motor Company, and Chrysler, well-known names in the car industry, brand names with record incomes, but not so for the average worker.
They should be paid more. The corporation is making billions of dollars. And these people have been with them and the cost of living and stuff like that. They've been with this company 20, 30 years.
Tens and thousands of the United Auto Workers are officially on a strike. The three Detroit automakers have failed to reach an agreement with the union, which represents about 146,000 workers. One major issue on the table, workers' pay. The union has proposed 40% hourly pay increases over the next 4 years. The average U.S. auto worker on a manufacturing production line earns about $28 per hour as of August. That's up only $1 from the previous year. The problem began on an agreement that the auto workers made with the government, which bailed out the big three automakers. The problem is, the workers hired in 2007 or earlier earned an average of $33 per hour, but the ones hired after 2007 earn only $17 an hour. Why? Because this agreement was made as a goodwill gesture to help the automakers get back on their feet after the crisis. But now auto workers' hourly earnings have fallen 19.3% since 2007. And that is not fair as they see it. Even the U.S. politicians see it that way, like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
The fight you are waging here is not just about decent wages and working conditions and pensions in the automobile industry. It is a fight to take on corporate greed and tell the people on top this country belongs to all of us, not just a few.
But strikes in the U.S. are happening at a more frequent pace compared to previous years. There were 424 work stoppages in 2022, including 417 strikes and 7 lockouts. Work stoppages increased by 52% from 2021 to 2022. The number of workers involved in work stoppages increased by 60% from 2021 to 2022. The number of striking workers as a consequence saw an increase. Since the year 2021, the numbers have been rising steadily, with 650,000 to have threatened to go on a strike so far this year. The strikes point to a deeper problem within the U.S. economy. Things are not that rosy when it comes to Americans' income and economic well-being. For example, homelessness has been on the rise in several states, most notably California, and also in New York City.
The unhoused population has exploded with the addition of the new arrivals. For example, here at St. Bartholomew's Church, where we start serving, we were seeing on average anywhere from 250 to 275 people, more or less regularly. Once the new arrivals started coming, our numbers got up over 400 people.
President Ebrahim Raisi has underscored Iran's full authority on its recently released assets. Raisi said it is the Islamic Republic that decides how to spend the funds and that the money will be spent, quote, wherever we need it.
This money belongs to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and naturally we will decide, the Islamic Republic of Iran will decide to spend it wherever we need it.
So if I hear you clearly, that it will be used for more than humanitarian purposes, in your view?
Humanitarian means whatever the Iranian people needs. So this money will be budgeted for those needs. And the needs of the Iranian people will be decided and determined by the Iranian government.
Raisi made the remarks in an exclusive interview with the American broadcast television network NBC in the capital, Tehran. He pointed to the last month's deal between Iran and the United States to exchange prisoners and to secure the release of $6 billion US dollars of Iranian funds that had remained blocked in two South Korean banks since 2018 because of US pressure on Seoul. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden claimed at the time that the funds and the proceeds of Iranian oil sales to South Korea could only be spent on humanitarian purposes.
The system is set up such that this money, these funds, can only be parceled out for humanitarian purposes.
The Biden administration has announced that it had taken concrete steps to clear the way for the prisoner exchange and also issuing a waiver that allows international banks to transfer the $6 billion to Qatar without the threat of U.S. sanctions. The waiver means that European, Middle Eastern and Asian banks will not be in violation of U.S. sanctions in converting Iran's money, which was frozen in South Korea, and transferring it to Qatar's central bank, where it will be held for Tehran. Top Iranian officials have emphasized that there is no connection between the prisoner exchange agreement reached with the United States and the release of Iran's frozen assets. U.S. sanctions have mostly targeted Iran's sale of crude oil and its ability to engage in dollar transactions in the global banking system. The Iranian funds were illegally blocked under the pretext of U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations has confirmed that five Iranians detained illegally in the United States on charges of circumventing U.S. sanctions will soon be released as part of a prisoner swap deal between Tehran and Washington. The five Iranian detainees were identified as Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi, Mehrdad Muin Ansari, Amin Hassanzadeh, Reza Sarhangpour Kofrani, and Kambiz Attar Kashani. The prisoner exchange agreement was officially announced on August 10th, following 2 years of indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington. In a gesture of goodwill, Iran has moved four American detainees from prison to house arrest. They joined the fifth American who was already under house arrest in Tehran. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has expressed the Islamic Republic's readiness to negotiate last year's draft agreement aimed at salvaging the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with the JCPOA, and removing illegal U.S. sanctions. Amir Abdollahian underscored the current administration's efforts to neutralize Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic while keeping the window open for negotiations to remove the illegal U.S. bans. The United States, under former President Donald Trump, abandoned the JCPOA in May 2018 and reinstated sanctions that the agreement had lifted. The talks to revive the 2015 deal kicked off in the Austrian capital city of Vienna in April 2021 with the intention of removing anti-Iran sanctions and examining the U.S. seriousness in rejoining the JCPOA. The discussions, however, have been at a standstill since August 2022 due to Washington's insistence on its hard-nosed position of not removing all the sanctions that were slapped on Tehran by the previous U.S. administration.
What the Americans want to do is have a JCPOA where they don't abide by their commitments in full, and the Iranians do so. And the Iranians are not going to have that again. When Obama signed the deal, he systematically violated the deal from day one. And then Trump tore up the deal. And Biden, despite criticizing Trump, he pursued Trump's maximum pressure policy, which was directed at ordinary Iranians.
Iran has consistently said that it has not left the negotiations with the Western side and that it was the United States which has blocked the talks with its excessive demands.
Iran's leader, addressing thousands of people from the provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and South Khorasan. He also said the U.S. and Europe do not have the same powers as before and are declining. The leader may be referring to the rise of powerful blocs like BRICS or the SCO. BRICS in particular has just recently expanded from its current five members to include new members like Iran and Saudi Arabia. And here's a map of the world outlining BRICS countries. It is pretty obvious how the U.S. and Europe are the minority. U.S. intervention in other countries' affairs, whether through wars, regime change, or economic sanctions, has led to the polarization of the world. The leader called the U.S. failure in Syria and the humiliating escape from Afghanistan two obvious examples of the decline of American power. It's a toss-up between which of these two failures were more humiliating. Right now, the U.S. is occupying Syria, looting the country from its oil, and selling it to provide for his troops there, and by many accounts, to support the terrorists in northern Syria. That is a low for any country. A big slap in the face to France and colonialism. From Mali to Niger to Gabon, African countries are rising against the colonial country France, which has held these countries captive economically. But the people of these countries have now risen, saying that enough is enough. Iran's leader has said you hear these days how the African countries that were under the influence of France are rising against it one after another. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader stated that Washington is working on ethnic and sectarian fault lines in Iran with the aim of creating a crisis in the country. Some of the areas that he outlined, called crisis points, are ethnic differences, religious differences, and the issue of gender and women. But this is something that the U.S. has executed for quite some time. Back in the year 2007, it was revealed that the CIA was funding ethnic separatist groups to create instability in Iran. These incidents were carried out by the Kurds in the west, the Azeris in the northwest, the Ahwazi Arabs in the southwest, and the Baluchis in the southeast. The incidents included bombing and assassination campaigns against Iranian soldiers and government officials. There was also the Iran Freedom Support, an act of Congress approved by the former U.S. President George W. Bush, that appropriated millions of dollars to spend money in support of groups opposed to the Iranian government. Iran's leader statements have come at a time when there is an intense campaign to turn the unfortunate passing away of Mahsa Amini's one-year anniversary into a violent one.
The commission is the premier UN body for promoting gender equality and empowering women. It cannot do its important work if it's being undermined from within. Iran's membership at this moment is an ugly stain on the commission's credibility.
One member, a bullying member, notorious for disobeying the UN Charter and international law, intend to pursue its unlawful request to remove an elected member from the commission only on the basis of unfounded claims and fabricated arguments.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker in the studio, shedding some light on some of the rules of impure substances based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, would you please tell our audience about the Sharia law and Islamic law or rule concerning the following question, in three parts, of course.
from the point of view of purity or impurity.
Yes.
What's the rule regarding the vomit of a breastfed child? And also of a breastfed child that is also fed some supplementary diet. And then also, what's the rule regarding the vomit of an adult?
Well, the vomit of an adult, someone, a child or an adult, throws up, is not necessarily impure. It's not impure in the first place, because it's the food that that comes out of the mouth, and it's not mixed with blood, not mixed with anything that is essentially impure. So it is food with some kind of liquid, and that's not impure. So whatever it is, the food that a child throws up, the breastfeeding child, or an adult, that is not impure. So there's nothing, there's no doubt about it, even though it is a kind of something, let's say, disgusting. It's not something you like it, but it's not impure at all.
I see. Okay. In an Islamic country, you might face some salespeople.
Yes.
All right. That, they might have a different religion, of course, and or their religion is unknown.
Yes.
Well, and they sell some food items while they're wet.
Sure.
Okay. So is it obligatory to ask them about their religion, or, will the principle of presuming a state of purity apply here? And does it make a difference if we are talking about another country, like a non-Muslim country?
Yes, that's a very good question. Well, it's not obligatory to ask about someone's religion if he is not Muslim. It's not necessary to ask him whether he is, let's say, a Buddhist, a Christian, or a Jew, because according to His Eminence, the principle of presuming the state of purity will be applicable to such a person. And of course, he is considered to be pure as long as you do not know that he is actually one of those people who is essentially impure, because it's very much likely that he might be one of the people of the book. According to all religious authorities, the people of the book, Ahlul Kitab, are pure. And it's always permissible to interact with them, to take food from them, and to eat from their food, as long as their food does not contain meat and animal ingredients.
And there are many factors involved, by the way. We are not talking about meat, by the way.
Yeah,
because the meat could not be slaughtered in the ritual way.
Yeah, the meat is haram to eat.
Yes,
even if it comes from a Christian or from a Jew.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the food that does not contain meat, of course, then you don't have to investigate. You eat the food that comes from a Christian, from a Jew, and from the people
of the
book.
Not even
the
kosher meat.
Kosher is something else. Kosher is also haram. It's haram because it's not slaughtered according to Islamic law. Though in some way, in some procedures, they follow the same method that we follow when it comes to slaughtering the sheep or the animal.
Yes.
But we cannot eat kosher because the person who slaughtered the animal is not Muslim. He did not recite takbir.
Yes.
He did not slaughter the animal in the direction of Qibla. And there are many conditions missing.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was a good answer to these questions. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, my guest speaker. And the topic we are delving into is some of the laws related to impure substances based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Tawheed, you know, we all know that not all of the members of the family are the same.
Yes.
And some members of the family might not be that careful when it comes to the rules of purity, right?
Yes.
And, well, there are family visits, and when some of these members of the family, you know, should pay visits to the other members of the family or to the same household, then, you know, some furnitures could be made impure, to the extent that it is not possible, you know, to wash or clean them.
Yes.
So in such cases, what's the duty, what's the religious law, you know, when it comes to the residents of that house? And how is it possible for the other members of the family to remain pure, to remain clean, especially, you know, in the state of, for example, prayers? We all know that some of the, you know, conditions for offering a prayer is the necessary condition of purity of
sure.
the place for the prayers to be accepted or for their validity, right?
Yes.
So what's the rule in this regard?
Well, it is not necessary to purify the house because it's sometimes very much difficult to do so. And the purity of the clothes of the person praying and the place of the place of the resting of the forehead during prayer is sufficient for the validity of the prayer. Because it's said that if you are praying, the place where you stand may be najis, but it is dry. But the place where you are going to prostrate, the place of sajda, if it is pure, then that's enough. Even though you know that the house is impure and the people, let's say, inside the house, the family members, they do not observe the rules of tahara, and you know the furniture and everything is very much likely to be impure. But as long as the place of sajda is pure, then you don't have to worry. And in such cases, when you, for example, happen to visit a relative who does not exercise precaution in matters of tahara, it's always recommended that you perform your prayer on a prayer mat, because that will make you sure that you have not stood on a, let's say, on an impure place. And the place where you do the prostration, the sajda, is also pure. So in order to rest assured that you are actually, that you are observing the rules of tahara and that everything that you do is based on purity, then it's very much recommended that you pray on a prayer mat. Or if there's no prayer mat, at least you can actually use some other things which you are sure to be clean.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed. And thank you very much, my dear listener, for joining us on Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, signing off.
جميل وهاب لطيف.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ahli Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently discussing on the topic of prophethood based on some of the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And presently we are focusing on the sermon number 192, or famously known as the Sermon of Qasi'ah, where Imam Ali alayhi salam developed some of the discussions with regards to prophethood. Especially the discussion that we are focusing on right now is about the times of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, especially the beginning phases of the coming of the Prophet, just before his coming and after his coming, with regards to the specific condition of the believers especially. Why we want to do that is to make us understand the fact that whenever there's a prophetic movement, whenever it wants to begin, or the sparks of a prophetic revolution have to start, then there are certain conditions that are normally there. And we should never lose hope when we consider the fact that those people at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam faced such difficulties. Then, of course, us and those people who wish to start this path of prophethood, follow that path and reignite that movement, would also face similar difficulties.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, considering the discussion we had, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about the fact that the early stages of the prophethood, when Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam started his movement, there were certain very difficult moments for the people, for the believers especially. For example, Imam Ali alayhi salam uses different terminologies to explain the difficulties. For example, he says, "Ajhad al-ibadi bala'an." They were the most, you can say, most struggling in front of difficulties and tests, these people who are there. Or for example, there are other terminologies that he uses here that shows the heavy weights they were facing. For example, he says, أَثْقَلَ الْخَلَائِقِ أَعْبَاءً. There were very many difficult tests for them. They were the tests were like heavy weights on top of them. So for example, they use also, Imam Ali alayhi salam uses even these terminologies. So what were those difficult tests that we could say the people were facing? Especially when it comes to a prophetic movement, when you want to start a movement of that kind, then you will definitely find oppositions of different forms, in different forms. So it's probably referring to that kind of difficulty. And just to give you an idea about these kinds of difficulties, there is an example that they give here. Some of the poets, they use these analogies. For example, they talk about the dog and the wolf, and then they make a comparison here. They say, if you look at the dog, now when I'm mentioning these comparisons, we should look at that point of comparison and not completely compare every aspect. We look at that aspect where we want to compare and not all of the aspects, you see. Here, the poet, there was one of the poets here who explains this and says that the dog is referring to that person who accepts oppression, accepts the rule of the oppressors above him, while the wolf is one who denies that oppression, and therefore he becomes alone, and he has to wander in the deserts. He becomes a lone warrior, like a soldier who is ready to fight for his rights and things like that. I'll come and explain that, a comparison, inshallah, in the coming segment.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
So basically what we were talking about is the fact that when these circumstances are brought about for the believers, especially when they want to start a prophetic movement, then they should always have that patience and realize that the people of the previous generations who are believers also faced that. And yes, they will face different kinds of difficulties. As I said, the example that one of the poets gives here is the example of a dog and a wolf. You see, a dog, when he is presented with some food, or when it is presented with some, you know, something tasty that it likes, it then bows down to its master and does whatever it wants, whatever the master wants. But the wolf is not like that. The wolf goes against the master, takes the food just for the sake of it. It doesn't want to obey that master. But in return for that, what happens is that the dog gets a good house, gets treated very nicely, enjoys a good life. But on the other hand, the wolf has to suffer a life of wandering in the deserts here and there. This is a good analogy in this aspect, that if you want to be a warrior and you want to be a hero, then you will have to say no to many forms of oppression. And when you say no to those forms of oppression, then you will have to carry the weight of your household around you. That means the food and drink and everything. You will have to work extra hard to be able to provide for your family. But the dog, no, because he is submitted to the rule of the one above him, who is an oppressor. In this situation, of course, please keep in mind the aspect of analogy that I'm making here. So what happens is the dog then lives a good life. He doesn't have to carry the weight of all the household expenses and the food and the drink and everything for the family, and just submits. And therefore, his family is happy and everything is going on well for him. So this is an example to show us on how many difficulties people would face, especially those who would wish to take a step against oppressive movements and take a prophetic step towards the path of light. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
In the limelight.
Gun violence has killed 123 people per day in the United States of America this year, with a total deaths including 1,079 teenagers and 216 children. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, U.S. President Joe Biden renewed his calls for Congress to pass more gun control in July after a spate of mass shootings. But, in contrast, conservative politicians have pushed for more gun rights nationwide. In Kentucky, Ohio, Nebraska, Texas, and Virginia, this year, 2023, Republicans have advocated for removing background checks, getting rid of red flag laws, and minimizing gun-free zones that limit where people can carry a firearm around others in public. There were 30,235 deaths involving a gun as of September 1st. At least 13,405 were homicides, murders, or unintentional shootings. The majority, at 16,830 or 69 per day, were suicides by gun, the archive found. Some states had far more suicides by gun than others, including Texas, California, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Illinois, and Louisiana. In two of these states, Texas and Georgia, Republican lawmakers have sought to have gun rights expanded while considering some gun control. Additionally, the United States has had 498 mass shootings as of mid-September. In Texas, there are ongoing calls to raise the minimum age for a person to purchase the assault-style weapon often used in mass shootings. It comes over a year after an 18-year-old gunman shot 19 students and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School in May 2022. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott, a staunch gun rights advocate, believes raising the age would be unconstitutional. Abbott and other right-wing politicians hold dear the Second Amendment, which gives all U.S. people the right to keep and bear arms. They also oppose any interference from the federal government, experts say. Carl T. Bogus, professor of law at Roger Williams University in Rhode Island, told China Daily, "We are a two-party system, and the Republican Party considers the gun lobby to be an essential component of its political coalition." In at least 25 states of the United States of America, legal gun owners do not need a permit to carry a handgun in many public places. The number of states that have this law in place has risen since 2020, when only 16 states allowed it. Abbott signed a law in 2021 allowing for permitless carry, which enables residents of the state age 21 and older to carry handguns without a license or training. He warned, politicians from the federal level to the local level have threatened to take guns from law-abiding citizens, but we will not let that happen in Texas. In April 2022, Georgia followed Texas in eliminating the need for a permit to conceal or openly carry a firearm. The recent move was hailed as a monumental moment for the Second Amendment by the National Rifle Association, or NRA, which remains a powerful gun rights advocacy group. Jason Oyment, executive director of the NRA's Institute for Legislative Action, said in a statement, "Half the country now rightfully recognizes the fundamental right to carry a firearm for self-defense as enshrined in our Constitution, as opposed to a government privilege that citizens must ask permission to exercise." Last year, the Supreme Court, which has more conservative judges than liberal, expanded gun rights. It also struck down a century-old New York gun law that required people to obtain a license to carry a gun outside their homes. The United States of America has more guns than people, with approximately 390 million firearms in circulation in 2018, compared to a population of 331.9 million people, according to the Small Arms Survey, a Swiss-based research project. Also, according to the Business Standard website, as gun violence in the United States of America grows at an alarming rate, survey finds that the United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans, and that's according to the Switzerland-based Small Arms Survey, SAS. While many Americans hold the right to bear arms as sacrosanct, other critics of the Second Amendment counter that it threatens the right to life.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم ما كسبت فوق قوتك فأنت فيه خازن لغيرك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, O son of Adam, whatever you earn beyond your basic needs, you will only keep vigil over it for others.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother. Now, George Jordak writes in his book, in the testament written by Ali for Malik al-Ashtar, one of his close companions, while appointing him as a governor of Egypt, Imam Ali says, appoint that person as a commander of your army, whom you consider to be most sincere and superior to others in the matter of humbleness and forbearance. This person should not be short-tempered and should accept an excuse from the people. This person should be kind to the weak, yet hard upon the powerful and oppressive. This person should not become hot-tempered due to the cruelty of the people and should not become helpless due to the weakness. And so George Jordak writes, thus it is evident, it is proved, that Ali was a peace-loving person. And he always recommended peace. It is so interesting that a Christian brother has reached this conclusion like the day shines
upon the earth, that Imam Ali was a peace-loving person. And yet, on the other hand, we have so many so-called Muslims who wrongfully say that Imam Ali was a war-loving person. So interesting that how has time changed that a Christian brother can teach us so much.